You are sitting there, aren't you?
Late at night, yeah.
Exactly. A university student, deep into information theory, just staring at your screens late at night.
Trying to map out the ultimate intersection of, physics and data.
Right. You are looking for that bridge, that connection between raw, unthinking matter and, well, algorithmic processing life.
It's the ultimate puzzle.
It really is. So I want you to step away from the code for a second.
So let the compiler rest.
Yeah, let it rest and paint a vivid mental picture with me instead. Imagine a wide, dark slate table, total blackness all around.
Okay, setting the scene. I like it.
On the left side of this table, resting under this really harsh, focused spotlight, you have a perfectly formed hexagonal snowflake.
Beautiful.
Right. And right next to it, under that same beam of light, a pristine cubic salt crystal.
So highly structured things.
Exactly. They're beautiful, rigorous, mathematically precise structures. Now, look at the right side of the table. Under another distinct spotlight, there's a microscopic, twisting, double helical strand of DNA.
Ah, the classic molecule.
Yeah. All three of these objects are highly structured. All three are, breathtaking examples of nature's architecture.
They really are.
To the naked eye, if you're looking purely at the geometric elegance, they look like products of the exact same fundamental ordering process in the universe.
They seem related.
Right. But the question that just haunts both physics and biology is are they actually the same kind of order?
And see, that underlying assumption that these structures exist on the same sliding scale of complexity is the exact cognitive trap that has derailed origins research for, I mean, nearly a century.
A century, wow.
Yeah. We look at the sheer elegance of the snowflake and we look at the unimaginable density of the genome and we just, we draw a straight line between them.
Like it's a natural progression.
Exactly. We assume that if the unguided laws of nature can build the crystal, then, well, given enough deep time, given enough raw energy, and a big enough chemical playground.
Those exact same physical laws can build the code.
Right. We treat biology as if it is simply physics scaled up.
And that extrapolation is exactly what we're putting under the microscope today. Our source material for this deep dive is incredibly specific.
And relentlessly rigorous.
Yeah, and completely unapologetic in its conclusions. We are unpacking Chapter 9 of Mohammed Tariq Arbab's 2026 dissertation, The Origin Enigma.
It's a fantastic read.
It really is. And the mission for our discussion today is analytically severe and absolute.
We are going to permanently dismantle what Arbab terms the false hope of self-organization.
The false hope. I love that phrasing. We are going to expose the ultimate category error in origin of life models.
Which is this pervasive, almost romantic assumption.
Yeah, that raw energy flowing through simple chemical systems to create physical order is somehow a stepping stone, like a precursor to energy creating living cells.
It is a profound category error,
Yeah.
one that conflates fundamentally different properties of reality. And to properly dissect it, we really need to approach this from our respective disciplines.
Absolutely. So, as someone who spends their life steeped in the laws of physics, I look at the universe and I see a machine that inherently generates structure.
You see order everywhere.
I do. I find the theories of thermodynamic self-organization to be mathematically beautiful and honestly physically compelling. I look at stars, galaxies, planetary formations, crystals.
The whole physical cosmos.
Right. I see matter spontaneously arranging itself into complex forms all around us. I am bringing the heat, the energy gradients, and the physical laws of the universe to the table here.
Your domain.
Yeah, because I genuinely want to believe that the bridge from matter to life is just a matter of thermodynamic threshold.
But coming at this from the rigid discipline of information theory, I see a fatal flaw in that physical extrapolation.
Fatal flaw.
Yes, because my focus is on the cold, hard laws of data, memory, semantic meaning, and algorithmic code.
The software side.
Exactly. While physics is exceptional at explaining how things stick together, information theory dictates what is actually required to store and process instructions.
Right.
So today, I am applying those theoretical constraints to show why physics alone, mathematically, fails to cross the threshold into biology.
Okay, let's start at the absolute foundation of matter then. Before we can even touch complex theories like dissipative structures or autocatalytic networks,
You have to define the boundary.
Right, the boundary between the two types of structural reality we just put on our hypothetical table. Because as a physicist, my primary argument is based on observation.
Which is?
Nature builds highly ordered, complex structures spontaneously all the time. It is just an inherent property of the cosmos.
Okay, true.
So if the laws of thermodynamics, molecular geometry, and internal bonding forces can naturally arrange simple water molecules into a perfectly symmetrical, endlessly repeating snowflake, or take sodium and chloride ions and lock them into a rigid, predictable salt crystal, why is it mathematically or conceptually forbidden for those exact same natural forces to build biological molecules over billions of years?
It sounds reasonable on the surface.
Right. If the laws of physics can build the crystal without a designer, without a mind, and without a pre-existing blueprint, why can't those identical laws build the cell?
Because that argument relies on conflating periodic order with a periodic complexity.
Periodic versus aperiodic. Okay.
Yeah. To an information theorist, a crystal and a DNA strand are not different degrees of the same phenomenon.
They aren't.
No, they are categorically fundamentally different physical states. R. Bob draws heavily on the foundational 1984 insights of physical chemist Charles Thaxton to establish this absolute boundary.
Okay, so break that down for me. Let's examine my salt crystal.
Right, your salt crystal. It is a flawless example of periodic order. It is highly structured, it is entirely predictable, and it exists in a very low entropy state.
Which is physics speak for very, very organized.
Exactly. But you have to look at why it has that structure. Its form is entirely dictated by the internal chemical bonding forces of its constituent
The
molecules.
physics forces it.
Yes. The sodium and chloride ions have absolutely no choice but to lock into that specific cubic lattice due to their electrostatic charges.
Right. The chemistry and the laws of electromagnetism physically mandate the shape. There is no alternative outcome for those specific ions in that environment.
Exactly the point. The pattern is physically forced. And because the pattern is forced by the unyielding laws of chemistry, its Shannon information capacity is effectively zero.
Rate zero.
Zero. In information theory, which Claude Shannon pioneered, information is fundamentally tied to uncertainty, freedom, and the reduction of surprise.
Okay, I follow that.
To hold data, a system must have the capacity to exist in multiple unpredictable states. If I know the physical laws governing sodium and chloride, I can perfectly predict the entire crystal lattice.
Whether it's a tiny grain of salt or a massive salt block.
Exactly. Whether it's 10 atoms across or 10 billion atoms across, I can predict it without requiring a single bit of additional data. There's no surprise, there is no variability.
So, because the outcome is guaranteed by the physics, the structure communicates nothing new. It's totally redundant.
It is the molecular equivalent of a typewriter, where every single key from A to Z is physically welded by steel rods to the letter A.
Oh, that's a brilliant analogy.
You can strike the keys with as much energy as you want for as long as you want, but every time the hammer hits the paper, it prints A.
You just end up with a page that says AAAA a million times over.
Right. It is highly ordered. It forms a perfect, repeating, predictable pattern on the page, but it is entirely devoid of semantic content.
You definitely can't write a novel with that.
You couldn't even write a grocery list with it, because the physical medium has no freedom to vary its output. It possesses zero informational capacity because the physical structure of the typewriter forces the result.
The medium and the message are identical.
Precisely.
But wait, how is DNA categorically different from that? At its core, I mean, DNA is just chemistry too.
It is chemistry, yes.
It is carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus. It is molecules binding together under the exact same universal laws of thermodynamics that govern the salt crystal.
It is chemistry, but the structural architecture of the molecule allows for something entirely different, a periodic complexity.
A periodic, meaning non-repeating.
Right. Let's look closely at the DNA strand on your side of the table. You have a long, continuous sugar phosphate backbone.
Okay.
Attached to that backbone are the four nucleotide bases: adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. Here is the crucial defining twist that changes everything.
Lay it on me.
The chemical bond connecting the sugar phosphate backbone to each of those four distinct bases is exactly identical.
Wait, identical. Walk me through the physical implications of that identical bond. Why does that matter to a physicist?
It matters because it means there is no physical, thermodynamic, or electrostatic law that forces an adenine to be followed by a guanine, or a cytosine to be followed by a thymine along the vertical axis of the helix. The internal chemistry of the molecule does not dictate the vertical sequence of the bases.
So the backbone is a structure, but the letters...
While the backbone forms a rigid, predictable, periodic structure, the sequence of the letters attached to it is chemically arbitrary.
Wow. So the chemistry allows any of the four bases to link up, but the chemical affinity does not care which specific one links next.
Exactly.
The bond works the same regardless of the letter.
And that specific chemical freedom, that lack of physical determinism, is what allows DNA to function as a genuine information medium.
Because it can hold any combination.
Right. If the chemical bonds force the sequence, if adenine inherently had a strong electrostatic necessity to bond to thymine in a linear vertical chain, you would just get a repeating molecular crystal.
Your sequence would just be AT, AT, AT forever.
Exactly. You would have periodic order, like your salt crystal, but you would have zero semantic information. For a physical medium to hold complex data, the medium must be completely decoupled from the message it carries.
Completely decoupled. Let me build an analogy for the listener studying info theory to really cement this concept of decoupling.
Go for it.
Think of a standard blank sheet of paper and a bottle of black ink. The chemical and physical properties of the ink and the porous nature of the paper fibers allow the ink to bind to the page.
Rest of physics.
Right, that's the physics. Uh-huh. But there's absolutely no chemical law, no electrostatic attraction, and no thermodynamic gradient within the ink itself that forces it to arrange into the shape of a Shakespearean sonnet instead of a complex mathematical proof.
Yes. Excellent.
The physical properties of the ink are completely indifferent to the semantic message being written. The physics provides the mechanism for storage, but the physics does not author the sequence.
That analogy perfectly isolates the boundary. The medium is decoupled from the content. DNA is a molecular medium decoupled from its content, which is what allows it to possess high specified semantic complexity.
It has the freedom to hold code.
It has the variable freedom required to hold a genetic algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Thermodynamic self-organization, the physical forces you are defending, only ever produces structures where the medium is the message.
Which means?
The laws of chemistry reliably produce crystals.
Yeah.
They do not, and mathematically cannot, write algorithmic code. The severity of this boundary cannot be overstated in origins research.
It's a hard wall.
It is not a matter of degree. It is a structural fundamental difference in kind.
That presents a massive roadblock for the physicist trying to build life purely from unguided matter in a lab.
A huge roadblock.
It means my pristine, highly ordered snowflake is structurally useless as a stepping stone for biology. It's an informational dead end.
Totally inert mathematically.
So I am willing to concede the static crystal. A frozen lattice of sodium and chloride is not going to wake up and start computing.
Glad we agree.
But here is where we must scale up the physics. Because the universe is not a static, closed block of ice, what if the system we are dealing with is dynamic, open, and driven by a massive continuous influx of raw energy? That is the reality of the early Earth.
Ah, I see where you're going. You are attempting to cross the boundary by introducing dissipative structures.
I am bringing in the heavy artillery of non-equilibrium thermodynamics. Ilya Pigozhin won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1977 for this exact theoretical framework.
He did.
He argued that order can emerge from chaos if you pumped enough energy through a system. Let's look at the classic example, the Barnard convection cell.
Okay, the fluid dynamics model.
Right. If I take a shallow pan of fluid, say a thin layer of oil, and heat it uniformly from below, something mathematically magical happens.
Heat transfer.
Exactly. At first, the heat transfers via conduction. But as the heat flow increases and crosses a critical threshold, the fluid doesn't just boil randomly and chaotically. It undergoes a spontaneous, dramatic phase transition.
The molecules organize.
They suddenly organize into these beautiful, highly structured, rolling hexagonal cylinders. Millions upon millions of molecules synchronize their movements in a macroscopic pattern to shuttle the heat from the bottom of the pan to the top.
It's an efficient heat engine.
It is. And so if raw energy flowing through an open system can organize billions of molecules into such a complex, synchronized macrostructure, isn't a living cell just a highly complex, dissipative structure?
You're asking if life is just a whirlpool.
Essentially, yes. Isn't a biological organism at its core just a sustained, incredibly intricate whirlpool of energy fighting off entropy?
I mean, it is a conceptually beautiful, highly romantic metaphor. Prigozhin's work was brilliant within the realm of fluid dynamics.
Ugh.
But as an information theorist, looking at the strict requirements for biological life, I must tear that extrapolation down completely.
Tear it down, really.
Completely. Prigozhin's leap from the thermodynamics of fluid dynamics to the algorithmic processing of biological life, is fundamentally flawed. To dismantle it, RBAB points us to the 2025 computational limits established by biophysicist Robert Andres.
Okay, what did Andres prove?
What Andres mathematically and physically proved is that dissipative structures are simply bulk matter seeking the most efficient path for heat dissipation. They were a thermodynamic trick.
A trick?
Yeah. The universe wants to reach equilibrium. When you block that path with fluid, the universe organizes the fluid to clear the thermal gradient faster. When you compare a convection cell to a living, metabolizing cell, you expose three catastrophic, insurmountable informational failures.
Let's test that. Let's put the convection cell up against the biological cell. What is the first catastrophic failure?
The complete absence of heredity.
Heredity.
Think about the mechanics of your Bernard convection cell. What happens the exact second you turn off the heat source under that pan of fluid?
Well, the thermal gradient drops. The driving force is gone. The hexagonal rolling cylinders immediately slow down, degrade, and collapse.
And then?
The fluid goes still and returns to a state of equilibrium. The structure vanishes entirely.
And it leaves absolutely no trace, no memory, and no record that it was ever there.
Because it's gone.
Right. The system possesses zero physical memory of its organized state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, compare that thermodynamic reality to biological reality. Life records its organizational information in a chemically stable, linear polymer DNA.
So life has a hard drive.
Yes. That information persists even when the flow of metabolic energy is completely paused. Think of a dormant seed buried in the desert.
Or a bacterial spore preserved in the Arctic permafrost for thousands of years.
Exactly. The energy flow is stopped. The metabolism is at zero. But the organizational instructions, the blueprint for the organism, remain completely intact.
Wow, that's a huge difference.
A convection cell relies on continuous, uninterrupted energy flow simply to exist. Life uses a physical hard drive to store its architectural plans, independent of the system's energy state.
That is a severe distinction. Mm-hmm. You are pointing out the difference between a whirlpool in a river, which only exists in the active presence of flowing water, and the architectural blueprint for a hydroelectric dam, which you can roll up, put in a drawer, and retrieve decades later to build the structure again. The whirlpool has no blueprint. It is the process.
Precisely the issue. Now look at the second catastrophic failure of the dissipative extrapolation, the absence of plasticity.
Plasticity, meaning Great. Flexibility.
Right. Your convection cell can only do one thing. It is incredibly rigid. It can only form the exact geometric pattern dictated by the fluid dynamics, the viscosity of that specific liquid, and that specific thermal gradient.
It's locked in.
It has absolutely no freedom. It cannot alter its hexagonal pattern to store new data. It cannot adapt to solve a complex problem. And it cannot invent a new way to move heat.
Whereas DNA?
DNA, on the other hand, is infinitely plastic. Because the bonds are chemically arbitrary, as we established earlier, the DNA strand can record any sequence. It is the biological equivalent of a universal Turing machine.
Okay, let's break that concept down for the listener. When we talk about a universal Turing machine in this context, we are talking about a system that can simulate any other computational system if given the right tape of instructions.
Yes. Alan Turing envisioned a machine with a read-write head and an infinitely long tape of symbols. The machine itself is relatively simple.
Its power comes from the tape.
Exactly. Its power comes from the fact that the tape can hold any conceivable algorithm. DNA is the tape. It can code for a muscle fiber, a retinal photoreceptor, a digestive enzyme, or a neurological synapse. The medium doesn't dictate the output.
So a convection cell is an inflexible, forced physical reaction to a thermal environment.
Yes.
While DNA is a flexible, programmable medium. The physics of the fluid dynamics only allows for one highly rigid outcome based strictly on the environment. But the biological medium is flexible enough to contain abstract software.
Spot on.
So what is the third failure Andres exposes in the dissipative illusion?
The information gap itself. We are dealing with two entirely different scales of structural reality. A convection cell organizes the bulk, homogeneous movement of billions of identical molecules.
It's huge, relatively speaking.
It is macro scale order. It's just a traffic pattern. Biological information requires the microscopic, exact, deliberate placement of individual atoms in sequences that are millions of units long.
Right.
A whirlpool moves a trillion identical water molecules in a circle. A biological ribosome precisely sequences thousands of specific distinct amino acids to fold a singular functional three-dimensional protein.
The scale is completely different.
Comparing the thermodynamic order of a convection cell to the specified complexity of a biological cell is like equating the complexity of a tornado throwing debris in a circle to the complexity of robotic microchip factory manufacturing processors.
That is a harsh analogy, but I get it. Let me construct a detailed analogy for the listener to really drive a wedge between energy flow and software.
Please do.
Because, as a physicist defending self-organization, the core tenet is always energy flow creates order. We see it in the Barnard cells. We see it in hurricanes. But let's apply that rule to information technology. Let's look at a complex computer motherboard sitting on a desk.
Okay, picture the motherboard.
If I take that motherboard, strip away its software, and just run a massive continuous electric current through it, just pure raw energy flow directly from a power line, what physically happens to that matter?
You generate a localized dissipative structure. The physics will immediately attempt to handle the energy.
Right. The system will desperately try to dissipate that raw voltage. The physical copper components will rapidly heat up. The silicon will burn. The board will radiate heat into the surrounding air, creating thermal convection currents.
The very rolling patterns we just discussed.
Exactly. You might even generate some highly organized repeating magnetic fields around the copper traces due to the flow of electrons. You are absolutely generating order and physical patterns strictly through energy flow.
But look at what that energy flow is entirely failing to produce.
I am generating heat, and I am generating magnetic patterns, but I'm certainly not spontaneously writing the semantic algorithmic code for a word processing program.
Definitely not.
The raw voltage is not compiling a web browser, and it is not writing the kernel for a new operating system. No amount of voltage applied for any amount of time across any configuration of silicon and copper is going to randomly generate functional software code.
And that is the ultimate inescapable takedown of the Prigogine extrapolation.
It really is.
Raw energy flow produces physical patterns to dissipate heat. That is all it is programmed by physics to do. Intelligence, or a pre-existing algorithmic system, produces semantic code.
So adding energy doesn't add code.
Pumping raw thermal or electrical energy into a prebiotic soup on the early Earth does not write genetic software. It just makes the soup hot.
It just boils the water.
Exactly. It might create a chemical whirlpool, but it doesn't write a genome. Energy is an absolutely necessary condition for a biological system to operate. You die without metabolism. But energy is never the author of the information within the system.
Man, I have to concede the pure physics argument here. The rigid crystal is dead, and the convection cell, while dynamic, is blind and memoryless. Bulk matter moving in a circle won't write a genetic code.
We agree there.
But what if we aren't just relying on pure physical energy flow? What if we pivot away from pure physics and enter the realm of theoretical chemistry?
A chemistry pivot. Okay.
Yeah. I want to introduce Stuart Kaufman's highly influential work from 1993, The Concept of Autocatalytic Sets.
Ah, you're pivoting to the metabolism-first approach to the origin of life. This is the attempt to bypass the need for a genetic code entirely at the beginning.
Exactly. I'm moving away from just boiling water and looking at the chemistry of the Hadean Earth. I'm arguing that in a highly diverse prebiotic soup, you have millions of different organic molecules bumping into each other.
Giant chemical mixing pot.
Right. Kaufman theorized that these molecules could form self-sustaining, deeply networked reaction cycles. Molecule A catalyzes the formation of molecule B. Molecule B happens to catalyze the formation of molecule C, and eventually molecule C loops back around and catalyzes the formation of molecule A.
A closed loop.
Through this collective networked behavior, couldn't this entire chemical system cross a sudden phase transition? Couldn't it suddenly lock into chemical life and begin evolving as a complete metabolic system entirely without a DNA or RNA sequence to guide it?
It is a mathematically elegant theory. And I have to admit, it looks brilliant on paper. But when we apply analytical severity to it, we have to ruthlessly critique the computational illusion that underpins Kaufman's entire model.
A computational illusion?
Yes. Kaufman's autocatalytic sets rely heavily on clean, binary computer simulations. In his virtual environment, he creates digital molecules that react neatly, precisely, and exclusively in the specific ways he programs them to interact to form those cycles.
Oh, I see. But the real world, especially the prebiotic Earth, isn't a sterile computer simulation running perfectly curated code.
Not at all. The kinetic reality of the early Earth is violent, messy, and chemically unforgiving.
It's chaotic.
In the real, dirty Hadean Ocean, bombarded by UV radiation, fluctuating wildly in temperature, full of interfering minerals. A highly diverse organic mixture does not cooperatively self-organize into a neat reciprocal circle of mutual assistance.
What does it do then?
It falls victim to the merciless laws of mass action kinetics.
Right. Chapter 2 of Arbab's text hammered this home when discussing the prebiotic soup. The primary antagonist to these beautiful cycles is the Maillard reaction.
Exactly, and we have to look closely at the mechanics of why that happens. If you have amino acids and sugars in the same diverse soup,
which you mathematically must have to even attempt to build these complex metabolic networks.
Yes. They do not spontaneously ignore each other to form a perfect, life-giving metabolic cycle, the kinetically favored pathway. The reaction that requires the least activation energy and happens the fastest is for the amino group of the amino acid to perform a nucleophilic attack on the carbonyl group of the sugar.
Meaning they chemically bind to each other instantly.
And irreversibly. They cross-link, they don't form a cycle, they cook into inert, highly complex, useless organic tar.
Tar, like literal gunk.
Yes. It's the exact same chemical reaction that causes a steak to brown on a grill or bread to crust in an oven. Kaufman's mathematical model assumes that the constructive, highly specific cooperative reactions will outpace the destructive cross-linking reaction.
But the chemistry says no.
The empirical laws of organic chemistry dictate the exact opposite. In an unguided, diverse mixture, the soup doesn't become a beautifully tuned metabolic cycle.
It becomes molecular asphalt.
The building blocks destroy each other before they can organize.
Man, I understand the kinetic hurdle. The tar is a massive problem. But I am going to play devil's advocate for the theoretical chemists for a minute.
I wouldn't expect anything less.
Let's say, against all chemical odds, by some sheer statistical miracle, an autocatalytic cycle actually managed to form.
A miracle cycle, okay.
Let's say it is isolated in some perfect little microscopic pore in an alkaline hydrothermal vent at the bottom of the ocean, completely protected from the UV radiation and the cross-linking sugars. It's cycling. A leads to B leads to C leads back to A.
Okay, I'm visualizing it.
It is actively processing chemicals. Doesn't that count as the spark of life? Once that cycle is spinning, can it undergo Darwinian evolution and eventually invent a genetic code?
It absolutely cannot. And this brings us to the ultimate brick wall for metabolism first theories.
Which is?
The heredity limit. This limit was most famously and fatally exposed by the late brilliant chemist Leslie Orgel.
Orgel's critique.
Yes. Orgel delivered a devastating critique to the autocatalytic set theory that complexity theorists have never recovered from. Even if you magically bypass the Maillard reaction and form this perfect protected chemical cycle, it has no genome.
No DNA.
Right. It has no digital medium to record information decoupled from its physical chemistry. Therefore, it is strictly mathematically non-evolvable.
Wow. I want to try to visualize this limitation for the listener. This essentially boils down to the spinning top analogy, doesn't it? Let me walk through how I view this purely as a physical system.
Go ahead, construct the system.
Imagine our miraculous, perfectly isolated metabolic cycle is a physical spinning top resting on a flat table. As long as it has chemical energy feeding it, it possesses dynamic stability.
It's spinning.
It's moving, it's processing raw materials, it's maintaining its cyclical state. It looks alive. Now, let's say there is a random chemical perturbation in the environment. A new molecule bumps into the cycle, or a slight change in the vent's temperature alters a reaction rate.
A bump to the system.
Right. In evolutionary biology terms, we would call this a mutation or an environmental pressure. We literally bump the spinning top. What happens to the physics of the top? It wobbles.
It definitely wobbles.
It enters a slightly different dynamic state temporarily. It might even spin a little faster or process a chemical a little more efficiently for a brief moment. But eventually the laws of physics take over, the energy of the perturbation dissipates, and the top inevitably returns to its original baseline physical equilibrium.
It settles back down.
It goes back to spinning exactly the way it was before the bump.
And you have to ask yourself, why does it inherently return to that original state? Why doesn't it keep the new faster spin?
Because it possesses absolutely no physical mechanism to remember the bump. It has no hard drive, no tape, and no code to record the fact that the wobble might have actually been functionally superior.
That is the heredity limit logbear. Without a digital sequence-based genome to actively record chemical improvements, any molecular progress is instantly and permanently lost.
Because it can't write it down.
If an autocatalytic cycle accidentally discovers a slightly more efficient pathway to process a nutrient, the moment that cycle resets, or the moment it is interrupted, or the moment it attempts to divide and replicate into a new pore,
that brief chemical knowledge just vanishes into the ether.
Exactly. Stability is not heredity. You can have a highly stable, complex chemical vortex, but without a semantic memory bank to lock in the errors and preserve the successes, you cannot ratchet up complexity.
You're stuck.
Darwinian evolution fundamentally requires memory. It requires a historical record of what worked. It cannot operate on a memoryless spinning top.
So if I am keeping score here, we've dismantled the static periodic order of the crystal. We've dismantled the memoryless whirlpool of raw energy and dissipative structures. We've dismantled the blind, unrecordable chemical spinning top of autocatalytic sets.
The list is getting long.
I am running out of physical theories. But I am going to make one final grand attempt to rescue self-organization. I am going to retreat into the most abstract, mathematically complex realm of systems theory. I am looking for a magical sweet spot in the universe where physical matter might naturally act as a computer. I am proposing the edge of chaos.
The final refuge of the complexity theorist.
It is incredibly popular for a reason. Complexity theorists absolutely love this concept. The core idea is that there is a theoretical, highly dynamic boundary poised perfectly between two extremes.
Order and chaos.
Exactly. On one side, you have the rigid, frozen, uncreative periodic order of our dead salt crystal. On the other side, you have the total, boiling, destructive randomness of our highly entropic Hadean soup.
And the edge is in the middle.
The argument is that the boundary between these two states, this razor-thin edge of chaos, is a zone of immense spontaneous creativity. It's a phase transition where biological innovation naturally flourishes because the chemical system is just stable enough to hold a basic shape, but just chaotic enough to constantly invent and explore new ones.
It sounds so appealing.
It feels intuitively like the exact environmental crucible where life would spontaneously emerge.
It is, once again, a profoundly romantic metaphor that sounds deeply compelling in a lecture hall.
I sense a but coming.
But we must shatter it with the same analytical severity we applied to the others. When you look closely at the molecular mechanics of what happens at that boundary, you realize the edge of chaos is not a magical cradle for biological innovation.
What is it, then?
In the absolute absence of prior biological machinery, it is actually a zone of rapid, inescapable physical degradation.
Wait, why is that? If it's mathematically the perfect balance of order and chaos, shouldn't it be highly generative? Shouldn't it be the sweet spot for trial and error?
You have to look at the informational mechanics of what operating at that ragged edge actually requires of a physical system. It creates what Arbab and others identify as the error correction catch-22.
The error correction catch-22, explain that.
Operating at the edge of chaos means your chemical network is exquisitely, hypersensitively attuned to environmental perturbations. That is the chaos part of the equation. The slightest fluctuation in thermal noise, the slightest introduction of a rogue water molecule or a microscopic spike in acidity will violently cascade through the entire system and drastically alter its state.
That doesn't sound like a cradle. That sounds like a recipe for constant overwhelming disruption.
It is entirely disruptive. Now, it is true that in modern, fully developed biology, living cells actually do operate very near this thermodynamic edge.
Oh, they do.
Yes. They require that dynamic flexibility to respond to their environment. But, and this is the absolute fatal crux of the issue, modern cells only survive this knife-edge existence because they already possess pre-existing, incredibly complex, highly specified error correction machinery.
You're talking about the molecular mechanics of DNA repair, the enzymes that literally patrol the genome looking for damage caused by that exact thermal noise.
Yes. Exonucleases,
yeah.
Mismatch repair proteins, proofreading polymerases. Modern biological life has an entire vast suite of software-encoded hardware whose sole dedicated purpose is to fight back against the chaos of that edge.
That's incredible.
When thermal noise inevitably breaks a chemical bond, or when UV radiation damages a nucleotide sequence, these sophisticated protein machines instantly recognize the structural error, physically cut out the damaged section of the code, and resynthesize the correct sequence based on the backup copy on the opposite strand.
So the narrative of the complexity theorist is completely backward.
Yeah.
Modern life isn't spontaneously flourishing because it sits at the edge of chaos.
No.
Modern life is actively, expensively fighting a relentless thermodynamic war against the edge of chaos just to survive it.
Precisely. The edge of chaos is actively trying to kill the cell every second of every day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mentally transport that reality back to your unguided prebiotic chemical network trying to balance on this theoretical edge in a hydrothermal vent.
It has rain defense.
It has no genome. It has no backup copy. It has no proofreading enzymes. It possesses zero error correction software.
The verdict for that system is absolute death.
Immediate, relentless, thermodynamic death. Without prior biological software to constantly, actively, and intelligently repair the system, any delicate chemical network perched at the edge of chaos is instantly torn apart by thermal noise.
It just shreds it.
The very environmental sensitivity that complexity theorists claim is creative and generative is thermodynamically lethal to an unprotected, uncoded system. It is not a cradle for life. It is a point of maximum chemical fragility.
So you just can't use it.
You simply cannot invoke the edge of chaos to explain the origin of life, because the edge of chaos will reliably and rapidly destroy any complex system that does not already possess an advanced, algorithmically encoded immune system against entropy.
Wow. We have really stripped the physics down to the studs today. Let's pull all of this together and synthesize what we've unpacked for the listener.
Good idea.
We set out to find if raw energy flowing through simple matter could naturally bridge the gap to algorithmic life. We explored crystals, convection cells, chemical cycles, and the edge of chaos. And we established absolute, unforgiving boundaries.
Hard thermodynamic limits.
Physics and thermodynamics are extraordinarily good at generating order. The universe gives us the flawless structural lattice of the crystal, the massive rolling currents of the convection cell, the predictable orbits of the spiral galaxy. But physics, acting entirely on its own, is mathematically incapable of generating information.
Because, as we established at the very beginning, information fundamentally requires in a periodic semantic sequence that is entirely decoupled from its physical substrate.
Like the ink on the paper.
Exactly. Physics binds matter based on rigid chemical affinities and thermodynamic necessity. Information sequences matter based on arbitrary symbolic rules to achieve a future goal. They are non-overlapping magisteria. You cannot get from one to the other simply by adding heat and time.
So to you, the listener, sitting there at your desk, grinding through information theory and origins research, you now possess the analytical tools to spot the great category error.
You'll see it everywhere now.
The next time you are sitting in a lecture hall or reading a peer-reviewed paper, and a professor equates the macroscopic complexity of a fluid whirlpool to the microscopic specified complexity of a cellular genome, you know exactly what they're getting wrong.
They are confusing a repetitive physical pattern with an algorithmic program.
They are mistaking heat dissipation for software engineering. They are looking at the chemical properties of the ink and tricking themselves into believing the ink wrote the book.
It is the defining fallacy of modern origins research.
Mm-hmm.
And once you truly see the boundary between periodic physical order and aperiodic semantic complexity, you cannot unsee it.
It changes everything.
No amount of raw energy, no amount of chemical diversity, and no amount of deep geological time can organically turn a thermodynamic sink into a cybernetic information processing system.
Which leaves us with a final, lingering, profoundly provocative thought to end on.
Let's hear it.
If unguided physical matter and raw energy flows are mathematically and structurally incapable of generating semantic or periodic code, and yet the foundation of all biological life on Earth runs on a highly specified, incredibly dense digital operating system, we are forced to confront the radical proposition put forward by the legendary theoretical physicist John Archibald Wheeler.
Ah, the concept of it from Bit.
It from Bit. Wheeler proposed that perhaps we have the hierarchy of the universe completely backward. Does the physical material universe, the Bit, it actually derive its existence and structure from pre-existing information, the Bit?
It turns everything upside down.
If the genetic code cannot possibly come from the unguided laws of physical matter, where does the foundational algorithmic information of the universe reside before matter is organized to express it?
If the physics didn't write the software, whose code are we currently running?
Exactly. Think deeply about that the next time you look at a rendering of a DNA strand. It's not just chemistry, it's data.